Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Asteroid City, No Hard Feelings, Secret Invasion, and Black Mirror Season 6. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Creepshow in 4K and The Pope's Exorcist on Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's look at the box office first, because this is kind of amazing what happened last weekend. The two big releases, The Flash and Elemental, completely cratered. They came in number one and number two, but they came in with numbers way below what they should have. The Flash, which was like over $200 million, has been anticipated for years, and it came in with $55 million for the three-day weekend. That's just the three-day. That doesn't count the Juneteenth holiday on Monday. But still, $55 million, that is $15 million below what it was tracking. And they'd already eased that tracking number back from over $100 million months ago when they were thinking that that's what it was going to make. And this was supposed to tie everything together. This was supposed to be the Spider-Man No Way Home of the DC Extended Universe. And it was catastrophic. Now, if you recall, I liked the movie, but people are trying to figure out why did this bomb so hard? And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact they're rebooting the universe. This feels like it's setting up stuff that's not going to get resolved or anything. So there's no way of enticing a crowd to come into a movie and say, yes, it's this multiverse movie for something that's ending. And I'm not talking about if, like, Marvel had said, we're going to completely end the Marvel Cinematic Universe after Endgame. That can put an end to it. But this was supposed to be ending this version and then also rebooting the next one. And this is what happens when you put everything in a pipeline and you don't have any ideas. And you're still shackled to the Man of Steel tropes from 10 years ago. I also think the problems with Ezra Miller, while that's not a giant thing for people, I think that cooled off a lot of people. Part of it is I've heard people blame the fact that the writer's strike is going on so you don't have evening talk shows. I don't know if that's as much as there was really no opportunity to do press without having a giant spotlight on Ezra Miller's legal issues. This is a number that's less than Black Adam from last year, and that killed that franchise with underperformance alone. Now, when it comes to Elemental, which also came in under $30 million, a little bit just a hair, it's like $29.6 million for the weekend. Again, that doesn't include the Juneteenth holiday, but the only movie from Pixar that opened lower than that was the original Toy Story, and that came out almost 30 years ago. So this is not good for Pixar. I think part of the thing with Elemental, It had middling reviews. It didn't have the push behind it. I think it was high concept, and it was hard to kind of figure out what the movie's actually about. There was no actual villain in it, which was kind of the point of it. But the other thing with this, there are no stars. Like, even something like Inside Out, which was very high concept, you had, like, Amy Poehler in there. At least you had somebody from a popular TV series at the time. She was on Parks and Rec. So this one, the only recognizable name for just normal mainstream, like, my wife saw it, and she said, at the end of it, she's looking at the credits and she says, I think Catherine O'Hara is the only name I recognize. And that can be a problem, especially when in this day and age, it matters who does the voices for the film. The other piece of news I want to talk about is about Secret Invasion. I'll be talking about that series in the segment, but I want to carve this out and bring this up as an issue. The title sequence for the Marvel series Secret Invasion uses AI. And there's a lot of people who've gotten upset over that. And I mean, with good reason, partly because one of the big issues with the writer's strike and the actors, and to a degree, the directors, is Hollywood is just chomping at the bit to be able to use AI software to generate everything from scripts to directing notes to actual images on the screen. And that's part of, I mean, aside from streaming residuals, which is a huge portion of the WGA's beef, they're concerned about AI. And this is probably just ill-advised for Marvel to use this at this time. Now, they couldn't have predicted it, maybe. I don't know, maybe they could have, but I don't think they could have predicted that AI would have become such a hot-button issue with a strike, because this all was initiated months and months ago. They have a reason for it, because in Secret Invasion, there are these alien creatures called the Skrulls who can mimic human beings. They can basically shapeshift. And that's kind of what I think the whole purpose of doing the AI generation, because it was this fake version of it. But then there's also the whole plagiarism issue that upsets a lot of artists, because it's still not resolved yet how much is plagiarism and how much is paying homage, because somebody can draw something in someone's style, but in AI, you're actually crunching those images into your software and not paying the people who you got those images from, the original artists. Now, if they had just used all production stills and stuff that was generated and owned by Marvel, I think it's a little bit different. But there's no information on that. There's a quick little, I think Polygon did an article about this, but they didn't go into the detail of it. It's just, they thought, oh, isn't this cool? We did this because the Skrulls are shapeshifters. Uh-oh, AI is a big hot button issue now, and that's causing problems too. So that's something interesting if you end up watching the series, and I'll talk about it later in the episode. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Cobweb, which is a horror movie which is coming to theaters on July 21st.
No more nightmares tonight. Okay, champ?
Daddy!
This is getting ridiculous.
This is an old house. There's bound to be bumps in the night.
Peter drew this?
Yes.
Is he all right?
Peter has an overactive imagination.
No more nightmares.
No more.
That's right.
This stars Lizzie Kaplan, and I'm a huge Lizzie Kaplan fan. I have a real thing for her. And, you know, I mean, I don't care. She's getting older. That's great. I'm getting older, so I'm all for it. But this is a horror movie about a family and this kid's maybe having visions, maybe having, and he's discovering nefarious things about his family. And at least the initial trailer doesn't look like it's too steeped in that dark and murky projection that we see now with that naturalistic lighting. But my biggest worry is I feel like everything's telegraphed in the trailer alone. I can't imagine how much is going to be telegraphed in the movie. I kind of have a feeling I know everything that goes on in this movie, and I have a feeling I know what the surprises and twists are just by how they're being so ham-fisted in setting up the trailer, especially when you watch it. You get a little bit of that in the audio bit, but when you watch the trailer, what might kill this movie is if it's too predictable. The next one I want to hit is Kraven the Hunter, which is a Sony property from the Spider-Man universe, and it comes to theaters on October 6th.
I stared death in the face, and for the first time, I saw my true self.
Tell me about this hunter.
They say he uses a connection with animals to track his prey. And once you're on his list, there's only one way off.
There's six of us, and only one of you.
There's six of you now.
Why do you hunt?
My father puts evil into the world. I take it out.
This is an R-rated movie. It's going to be bloody, it's going to be violent, and stars Aaron Taylor-Johnson as this character of Kraven the Hunter, which is from Marvel Comics. And they have a little tease. That's not in the trailer I played, but they have a little tease near the end of the trailer that this might involve the Rhino as well. And they've been trying to get the Rhino into the Spider-Man universe for years, ever since the Andrew Garfield movie of Paul Giamatti shows up as the Rhino at one point, and then we just never got a sequel to that. They've been trying to make this Sinister Six movie happen forever, and it just isn't working. Now, this looks better than like something like Morbius, but it might fizzle. But who knows? These both Venom movies are awful, and they tend to do really well. So maybe Kraven the Hunter will do okay. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Black Mirror Season 6. And no hard feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some reviews. The first thing I want to review is Black Mirror Season 6. Now, it dropped last week. I just didn't have time to talk about it last week. I had a full show. But I wanted to talk about this because I love this series. I love anthology, not just series, but movies. But I love anthology TV series. Mainly because I love the concept of a short story. I love the delivery of a short story, and that's essentially what these things are. I've seen all the Black Mirror episodes. Some are better than others, but what I like about Black Mirror is it's like a British version of The Twilight Zone and The Darkest Timeline. It deals with some really heavy, unflavorable things that go on in these episodes, and season 6 has got some of that as well. 5 more installments in this anthology series that take a look at technology and the darker side of humanity.
Let me show you how this will play out. 3, 2, 1.
You know none of this is right.
I love this.
Yowza.
I love it.
Oh, do you?
It's all anyone can talk about.
There are 5 episodes in there, and like any Black Mirror season, there's ups and downs. Some are better than others. One you may have heard a lot about is Joan is Awful, which stars Annie Murphy. She's best known for Schitt's Creek. And in the story, she's basically this average everyday woman who's has issues, but nothing really out of the ordinary for just average people. And it turns out that they're making a TV series based on her life. And I mean, it's like shot for shot. And it's done on, well, Streamberry is the in-episode version of Netflix. And it's basically an AI-generated show that reveals everything about her life. And there's a lot more to it, but it is a brilliant episode. I think it's amazing because it comes out right at the same time that AI is really heavily in the news, partly because of the writer's strike and what the actors are worried about. And this stuff has been a concern of actors for a while, even going back to the movie The Congress from 2013, which was about Robin Wright, who licenses her image and sort of the blowback of that. That's an okay movie. This episode of Black Mirror, it's brilliant. The Jonah's Awful episode is the best one of this season because it's dark and it's hard hitting, but it's also can be extremely funny and clever too. It's really good. The other one that's really good is the last one in the series, which is Demon 79. And that's brilliant, not just because it plays homage to Art Garfunkel's song Bright Eyes from Watership Down. I love that movie and I love that song, but it's about this Indian girl who works in a British store who gets tied up with this demon and has to do human sacrifices. It's dark and it's creepy, but again, it has a certain level of humor and a level of reality that's at times very disturbing, which is very on brand for Black Mirror. Now, the ones in the middle are a little bit iffy. There's one called Sea of Tranquility, and that one stars Aaron Paul and Josh Hartnett. I did not like that one. I overtly did not like that one, not because it has unpleasant stuff in it, and it does. What I didn't like about it, I thought that the characters were poorly put together. And maybe it was realistic for what the characters did for the way they set up these characters, but I thought it was just lazy archetypal design. The middle one, which is called Lock Henry, is really creepy and really well done. That one, but it is also, it gets under your skin and it's very disturbing. That one's very good. And then the fourth one in the series, that one's okay. It's a relatively standard story. It doesn't have, it's not like transcendent, like something like Joan is Awful is transcendent. It really hits on topics that really feel unique. This one, what is it? Daisy May, I think is it what it made, Daisy Mays or something like that. And that one's okay. But it's a great season. I enjoyed it. I mean, it continues to deliver that edge of Black Mirror with a set of stories that range from brilliant to bland. But I'm going to have to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about No Hard Feelings. This was not screened for me, so I got to dance around this a little bit. I didn't get a chance to go see this one. I had way too much stuff to do this week. Stuff in real life was taking priority over going to see a movie that the studio refuses to show me. Anyways, in No Hard Feelings, a struggling Uber driver is hired by a couple to date their adult son in order to introduce him to a grown-up life.
I'm an Uber driver and I don't have a car. I'm going to lose my house. Need a car, date our son this summer, and bring him out of his shell before college.
In exchange, we'll give you a Buick Regal.
Date is in quotes.
You know, we tried everything to bring him out of his shell.
So when you say date him, do you mean date him or date him?
Yes.
Date him. Date him hard. Okay.
I'll date his brains out. This kid is undateable.
Have a drink together.
He'll have a Long Island iced tea.
This is the worst iced tea I've ever had.
Now, when they say date, you know, even the play to it in the trailer, they're like, anything's on the table is essentially, I think, what the parents are saying. And this is meant to be a raunchy sex comedy. These things are popular. They're sort of like the modern breed of raunchy sex comedy is about 15 years old. I mean, it really was sort of redefined the Judd Apatow style. Stuff like Knocked Up or Superbad became the new standard for raunchy comedy, as opposed to stuff like Bachelor Party and Porky's that were very much from the 80s. Modern raunchy comedies are different. This is done by the people who did, or the director, I think, did Good Boys, which is a fun movie. I thought Good Boys is a hoot. That's the one with the three, like they're 12-year-old kids, and they stumble into a bunch of things that are very inappropriate for 12-year-olds. And that one's a very funny story because that one captured what it was really like to be 11 or 12 and to be confronted with some of these adult elements that you don't know what they are. Now, like I said, they did not screen No Hard Feelings, at least for me. They did screen it elsewhere, but the fact that they screened it on like Tuesday night in Los Angeles and New York, the Tuesday night before it opens, you know that they're trying to hide the reviews. We well know that when they don't screen a movie, they're trying to get around bad reviews. But also if they kind of partly screen a movie, if they screen a movie only in the major markets and it turns out they're only screening it a couple days before it comes out, they do not have any confidence in this movie. As opposed to something like next week, I'll be talking about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. Well, that thing was shown at Cannes and LA and New York, and I got to see it like last week. So, I mean, they actually have a little bit of hope that this movie's going to click with the critics. But something like No Hard Feelings, I think they were terrified. And for me, this looks like it might be funny. What I've heard about it is it all hinges on Jennifer Lawrence. It's all on her shoulders. And her, as an actor and a performer, she's what makes it work. She actually brings a level of quality to the movie, from what I've heard, that otherwise wouldn't be there. If you had somebody else who didn't have the connection to an audience and didn't know how to play a nuanced character, even if it's an obnoxious character, it would suffer. And I've heard that there's a sweetness to it. But it is just a stupid, raunchy comedy. Like I said, they didn't show it to me, so it's going to get a preemptive suck. But I'm curious to see it. I'm sure at some point I'll see it either on Blu-ray or I'll catch it on streaming. There was that Fantasy Island movie made, I don't know, like 5 years ago, and it still hasn't showed up on a streaming service. It's on like Stars. But I don't have that, and I'm not going to bother to get that just to watch Fantasy Island. I'm not going to rent it. When it shows up on some of these other platforms, I might check it out. But that's, I feel like that's what it's going to be like for No Hard Feelings. I mean, I really like Jennifer Lawrence as an actor. This looks like it hinges on, even in the trailer, you can feel that the weight of the script's on her shoulders. But yeah, they didn't show it to me, so I'm going to have to give it a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Asteroid City and Secret Invasion. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews and talk about Asteroid City. In 1955, a group of tourists are quarantined in a desert town after an alien visitation.
You're not here.
We're not there. The car exploded.
Where are you?
Asteroid City, Farm Route 6, Mile 75.
What do those pulses indicate?
What? Oh, the beeps and blips? We don't know.
Some of our information about outer space may no longer be completely accurate. Anyway, there's still only 9 planets in the solar system as far as we know, Billy?
Except now there's an alien.
I don't like the way that guy looked at us. The alien.
How did he look?
Like we're doomed.
Maybe we are.
If you haven't heard about this, this is the latest Wes Anderson movie. And there are a few directors out there. This is the whole auteur theory of film. There are several directors out there that you can recognize that person's style by the type of movie they do. And Wes Anderson is absolutely that type. And Michael Bay is as well, for that matter. I mean, they're on opposite ends of the spectrum, but they're both very recognizable directors. While I don't like Michael Bay, I love Wes Anderson. I have loved Wes Anderson for literally decades. One of my favorite movies of all time, and I have to go back and revisit this, and maybe I will later this summer, is The Royal Tenenbaums. I love that movie. It was one of the first DVDs I ended up getting. I remember requesting it for Christmas. I love that movie. It's brilliant. Now, his earlier stuff, he did these two other movies. He did Bottle Rocket, which is okay, but he hasn't developed a style in that one. Rushmore, which is very popular. I'm not a huge fan of Rushmore, but he was really starting to get to his style, but it sort of perfected kind of post-Tenenbaum. And Asteroid City absolutely feels like a Wes Anderson movie. It has all that symmetry and static camera. The framing device is it's a play in front of an unseen audience, but it's hyper real when we watch it. So it's not really like watching it on a stage, but everything feels very false in the backdrop. You know, it feels like it sets. And that's kind of the point. It's sort of these hyper realistic color. There's this sort of pastel palette to it. And it takes this utter panic of what goes on, but it frames it in a Wes Anderson way where nobody's really panicking. Everyone is just dealing with it very low key and, you know, softly. And that's very much Wes Anderson's mode. And recently he's been playing around a lot with the framing of the story, especially The French Dispatch was a great example of him having a story about people telling stories. And that's essentially what you got here. I like this movie better than The French Dispatch. I felt The French Dispatch was a little bit busy. It just had a lot of characters and a lot of things going on. I mean, I should go back and revisit that one as well, but it was not my favorite Wes Anderson. It was the first movie in decades that I really wasn't a huge fan of from Wes Anderson. But Asteroid City, I was taken in immediately. I love the quirkiness. I love the strangeness. Now, if you don't like that, do not go see this movie. If you're one of those people who roll their eyes anytime something looks at all vaguely Wes Anderson-ish, do not go see this movie. You will come out hating it. But if you like his stuff, you're going to love it. I mean, it has all those elements. And the thing is, there's a lot of stuff buried in there, too, because it works on these levels. And then, of course, within that, there's things that are unreal happening within the production. So it almost has three or four layers of storytelling. There's a lot to digest in this movie. You might think it's just sort of throwing it out there and letting it go, but it deals with xenophobic panic of the 50s. It deals with a realization that the world is bigger than ourselves. There's a lot of brilliant stuff in this movie, and it has a massive cast. I mean, some of the people, and it's nice to see some new ones. I'm not used to seeing Steve Carell in a Wes Anderson movie. I mean, everybody's seen Jason Schwartzman. Like, Tom Hanks is in it? And it shifts from the perspective of the children to the adults almost effortlessly, but it's also how people process grief and how people communicate grief. Now, there's a section of the movie where it kind of pops out of the play that the unseen audience is watching, and it comes really close to explaining itself. And I don't want a movie like this to explain itself. Sometimes you see a movie and you're like, okay, you're just being deliberately obtuse. I don't like that. But Wes Anderson knew exactly what he was doing, and I don't want him to overexplain. You should not overexplain your stuff. You put it out there and you let people interpret it. And so your interpretation may not be what Wes Anderson intended, but that's kind of the nature of art. Fans of Wes Anderson will lose their minds over this one. But if you don't like his style, you're going to roll your eyes throughout. Personally, I love his stuff. I think it's brilliant. I'm going to say Asteroid City totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Secret Invasion. This Marvel series sees Nick Fury working with an undercover Skrull to stop an alien terrorist cell.
This is personal.
Very few of us know about the wars fought in the shadows that have raged on this planet. You feel responsible.
This war is one I have to fight.
Alone.
You're the most wanted man on the planet.
You don't know what they have planned for you.
There are several different types of Marvel programs, we'll say. And some of them, like the Iron Man films, are very basic, standard gee-whiz superhero, but kind of grounded. I mean, yeah, it's a guy in a super suit, but it's grounded in this. If this guy could create this suit, this is what would happen. Then there's like the cosmic level of stuff, and that's the things like Thor, Love and Thunder, Ragnarok, Loki, or even something like WandaVision was very cosmic. It had all this, like, dealt with like magic and godlike creatures and everything. And then there's the more pragmatic, dramatic action properties. Great example is Captain America and the Winter Soldier, the second Captain America movie, which plays a lot like 3 Days of the Condor. And that's just a standard political thriller. And yeah, they're dealing with fantastic elements and they're dealing with Hydra and everything, but it really is these two people on a run trying to figure out a mystery. The Falcon and the Winter Soldier TV series is also like that, where, yeah, it's about super soldiers, sure, but anything that kind of comes from those Captain America things, they tend to be a little more grounded and more, you know, almost like a political thriller. This falls in that category. Even though the Skrulls were really more introduced in Captain Marvel, which leans into the cosmic powers, and the Ms. Marvel is a cosmic thing, but they pulled the Skrulls back. And as long as you get past that sort of suspension of disbelief that the Skrulls are there, you really get a taut political thriller. And there's parallels you can do. There's allegories and symbolism in here. It's about xenophobia and terrorist cells. They played around a lot with this in the Falcon and the Winter Soldier TV series, because they're all the people that came back after the blip and they felt like they didn't have a place anymore. And it's dealing with refugees and those themes. And this one borrows a lot of those themes, and it's not people from the blip, but it's aliens that were told that they were going to get their own planet, and they still haven't. And it does play around with terrorist organizations and cells and extremist groups, but because you can put it as the Skrulls and the aliens are representing that, people don't feel necessarily attacked. Whether it's supposed to represent ISIS, or whether it's supposed to represent white supremacists, or whether it's supposed to represent eco-terrorists, whoever the representation reflection is can watch it and get that messaging without feeling like the finger's pointing at them. Exactly. And if you think that it's pointing to you, maybe you're a little bit too far gone already. But yeah, I like this one. I like the fact that it wasn't as huge as some of the other Marvel stuff one. I like the fact, as much as I love the cosmic stuff and the goofy, silly stuff, it's very grounded and politically taught. I like that too. So, I mean, it's more gritty and grounded than the cosmic Marvel series, but this leads characters in a politically charged thriller in the tradition of Captain America and the Winter Soldier. I'm going to say that this totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be doing the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Creepshow on 4K and The Pope's Exorcist. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's wrap things up with a look at some movies that are coming out on Blu-ray 4K, because now I'm going to break into some of the stuff that's in the archives, and it is time for us to look at these new releases. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, and that sound means it's time to roll into the Home Cinema Roundup. Today's spotlight, I got two of them, actually. The first one I want to talk about is Creepshow, which has been released on 4K by Shout Factory, and that 4K comes also with a Blu-ray. George Romero directs this anthology movie of Stephen King horror stories based on the old EC horror comics from the 1950s.
Now, for the first time, the masters of horror, Stephen King, author of Carrie, Cujo, and The Shining, and George A. Romero, creator of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, have teamed up to make a movie that will give you the creeps. Creepshow. The most fun you'll ever have, being scared. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parent.
That was actually an original radio spot from the 80s when it originally came out. I found that, and it's actually on the Blu-ray and the 4K, and I thought, oh, this will be a neat thing to play as a trailer. First of all, I've talked about Creepshow before, but that was like 5 or 6 years ago. It's worth revisiting, and definitely worth revisiting because this 4K is packed with stuff. But really, let's talk about the movie first of all. The movie is what I consider one of the best comic book movies ever because it really encapsulates comic books. More so than even like when Ang Lee did the Hulk, he tried to use the framing of the panels of comic books. That wasn't as good as what they did with Creepshow. And I've read the old EC horror comics. I actually have a handful of them, the originals. They're not in great condition, but I got them from my father. And they're such great pulpy, very simple horror stories. And Stephen King wrote 5 of them, and most of them are from previous stories he had written and published in, like, Cavalier magazine. And it's directed by George Romero. It's also my favorite George Romero movie because he has a lot of fun. He does the horror stuff, but he's not shackled with The Night of the Living Dead. Yeah, there's some zombies in it, in both Father's Day and in Something to Tide You Over, but they're not George Romero zombies. The whole movie's not about zombies. It's not him trying to make a political point about consumerism as it is in Dawn of the Dead or the military-industrial complex, which is what he did for Day of the Dead. This is kind of a wholly original thing, and it was this confluence of brilliance. And then they never quite lived up to it. They did a second Creepshow movie, and that thing was kind of terrible. They did a third Creepshow movie, which came out 15 years ago or so, and it was direct-to-video. It was not very good. Tales from the Dark Side, I talked about a couple weeks ago. That was originally going to be Creepshow 3. And then they did a TV series on Shudder, and that's not bad. But nothing quite reached the greatness of it. And one of the things that's so great about Creepshow is the cast is amazing. I mean, it's this pulpy, cheesy, corny, sci-fi horror movie. And it's got like Hal Holbrook in it and Dennis Weaver and Adrian Barbeau and E.G. Marshall and Leslie Nielsen, who was at the time, I mean, he was a respected actor. He had just done Airplane right before it, but he really wasn't known as the comedy guy that he turned into kind of from the 80s into the 90s. But it has a fantastic cast. It's a very impressive cast because these people treat it like it's worthwhile. It's like I've been watching old Doctor Who episodes, and one of the things I love about the BBC actors in that series is even if it's cheesy, pulpy, silly, bug-eyed monster stuff, they take the acting seriously, and that's what makes it work. It sometimes gets a little bit corny with that, but that makes it work. And now the 4K, they got a new transfer to it, and it's beautiful. In fact, I was watching on a 4K TV, and I mean, like, you can see on the corner of the screen, there's like a couple beer bottles. You can read what's on the beer bottles. It's amazing the amount of resolution you have on this, to the point that you can see when they throw in an optical that the optical gets more grain. That's very apparent on the 4K because that's preserved on the original print. It looks gorgeous. It has great color. The image is fantastic. Now, I had a Blu-ray of Creepshow that Warner Brothers had put out years ago, and it was fine because it had the movie on it, but it didn't have any special features. This thing is loaded with them. Not only does it have the new scan, but it's got, I think, what, 3 audio commentaries with, like, George Romero and, like, the cinematographer and the assistant director. And then you have a bunch of interviews with the people who were involved in the thing. And then there's a bunch of behind the scenes stuff. There's like a roundtable discussion from 2018, a look at how they designed things to look like a comic book, some horror convention stuff. Tom Savini has some old behind the scenes footage. Then there's some deleted scenes, which I'd never seen before. And they're grainy and they come from a work print, but it's neat to see those. And some of those scenes actually were in, I had the original graphic novel by Bernie Wrightson, who'd drawn the graphic novel. And some of those scenes are in the graphic novel, which is kind of cool. And of course, you know, the trailers and TV spots, radio spots, which I talked about. I love Creepshow. It's one of my favorite horror movies of all time. It was very impressionable to me as a kid. I saw it when I was 11. But yeah, it's a classic, gruesome Stephen King pulp, which makes for one of the best comic book movies of all time. Creepshow totally rocks.
It rocks. Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to continue on with The Pope's Exorcist, which I think this actually dropped last week, but there was a mix-up in getting the disc sent to me. And I specifically wanted to revisit this because I did not like this when I saw it in theaters. So let's introduce it and talk a little bit about it. Russell Crowe stars as the Vatican's main exorcist who must face a demon possessing a child in a Spanish abbey.
There's a case that needs your attention.
Bring me the priest.
I'm here to help, Julia.
Wrong place!
Take caution. There are secrets buried there.
Is the Vatican sealed?
The Church has fought against this demon before. The Vatican covered it up.
Listeners of the show will know that I did not like this at all when it first came out. And the reason was I went to go see it at a theater. And I couldn't tell what the heck was going on. It was so dark. And I wanted to give it the benefit of the doubt. And I do owe a little bit of an apology to The Pope's Exorcist, because in watching the Blu-ray, yeah, it has some dark moments, but the color balance is so much better. The light balance is so much better. And I'm leading myself to believe that the problem with what I saw was not the movie, but it was the presentation. And that's endemic today. There are a lot of theaters that don't want to pay for new bulbs, and so they run them at a lower setting, or they don't replace them when they should, and you end up with stuff that's so dark it's impossible to see what's happening. I mean, there were literally moments when I saw this in the theater that I couldn't tell what was actually going on. It was hard to discern. But watching it at home, I got it all. Now, with that said, it looks better as a movie. Still not a great movie. Exorcism films are very difficult because The Exorcist was such a good one. And you either are imitating it or you're going too far away from it. There's no easy way of doing it without being compared to The Exorcist, especially when you have the word exorcist in the title of your movie. Now, I loved Russell Crowe in it. I thought he was great. I thought he did a great job adding humor and reality and pathos to this character. The other characters, not so much. One of my issues, and it's still my issue with this movie, is the family. It's this mother with her two kids, and the father had gotten killed in a car accident, and the son had witnessed it, and so he's never spoke since, and he's the one who gets possessed. And so it's this really fractured family. And that is popular now, because it's a big thing to channel grief and trauma as a horror movie. It's getting a little old, but one of the things that's terrifying about something like The Exorcist is it's just very normal family. I mean, the girl, Reagan, is just this sweet 12-year-old girl, and this is what happens to her. If you've got a fractured family and everybody's hating each other and this kid's traumatized and can't speak and is catatonic, yeah, you can sit there and be like, well, at least my family's not like that. What made The Exorcist work was the it could happen to you factor, and that was effective. Now, the other thing in this movie is they go too big, too easy. It's too much special effects. Again, going back to The Exorcist, oh yeah, there is a lot of effects and a lot of gruesome effects, but it built to it. It didn't start out with screaming and yelling and crashing. It started out with small, subtle things. And just because you can do digital effects in the eyes does not mean it's a good idea to do that. So all the possession moments, just they're sensationalized. They don't feel real. And part of a movie like this, you need to make it feel real, because that's where it really gets under your skin. So it's still not a great movie, but it looks a heck of a lot better on Blu-ray than it ever did in the theater. And that's the danger of going to theaters now. So I'm going to have to say it still kind of sucks, but it's way better than I thought it was.
It kind of sucks.
Okay. And that's it for this show. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.